I'll start off today by introducing you, hopefully not introducing you, maybe reacquainting you with the word and concept of Bildungsroman. Bildungsroman, which is at the heart of both Ursula K. Le Guin's writing and Naomi Alderman's writing, and arguably that of J.K. Rowling and George Lucas and others as well. Because Bildungsroman basically translates from the German, which literally deals with how a person grows up. It's a novel or a tale about the way in which we proceed from adolescence to adulthood. And the tale is as old as time itself in many ways. And so really, although this week I've entitled it Feminist Science Fiction and Fiction, and obviously it relates primarily to that, as far as we're actually considering two women writers, and more, and probably also opening up to various other things, both of them actually fulfil that brief of being young adult fiction, in the classic sense of how we see the narrative developed and put on. I'll do a usual show of hands so I can know which I want to sort of pitch this out, because it is one of those areas where there were two options, or indeed you could do both, which would be fantastic if you have. Has anybody actually read both Tales from Earthsea, or at least one of the Tales of Earthsea, and The Power? Okay, has anybody read The Power? Good. And what about Ursula Le Guin's Tales from Earthsea? A few from that. Okay, right. Well, let's look at the point of view of Alderman's The Power, because clearly we've got a classic inversion text there in which, due to something, which again is alluded to in the text in terms of obviously manipulations and gas and genetic engineering and so on and so forth, suddenly women develop this scheme, this ability to effectively project energy and lightning and electricity and so on. And the text effectively sort of outlines the way in which in this hypothetical reality we see a change in sort of delivery. We see a number of sort of key things there. We see the religious icons that work through, the kind of the American setup. You've got the Islamic setup, you've got the African setup, you've got the character of Tunde, of course, who is very much at the heart of a sort of sequence as a video journalist, a VJ in many ways. And you've got, again, an interesting narrative which opens its way through. And that line that I was talking about in terms of Bildungsroman really relates to probably the character of Roxy more than ever, because she actually grows through the whole process and grows up and develops in all sorts of ways. Clearly, in terms of Earthsea, we're looking at Ged, the musician, the magician, and how he sort of effectively goes through this process. Interesting enough, from a literary analytical point of view, the title Earthsea is one of those wonderful structural binary oppositions, because it's the difference between the earth and the sea, two of the fundamental aspects of experience, really, of sort of things. I mean, the old classic Greeks would say that there were the four humours of earth, wind, fire, and water. And out of that, effectively, you get all the creation of where we are today and so on. And actually, you can relate that to Alderman's line in terms of the power, because that also starts off with the notion of the Book of Eve. There is the sort of the way in which it's written as a historical novel by Neil Adam Arman, who I'm sure you'll appreciate is simply a wonderful reworking of Naomi Alderman in terms of changing the word around from that point of view. But clearly, apart from the similarity of gender, both Le Guin and Alderman are keen to transmit their narrative, keen to develop, keen to address a storyline and to work through that process. It's interesting that Le Guin's fiction has often been criticised by feminist critics, the line that I'll show you later, for its heterosexist framework of complementarity. And I've actually thought over the years, over the last two or three years, maybe Left Hand of Darkness, which very much deals with gender fluidity, would have been a much better choice than Earthsea. But I kind of stuck with Earthsea because, as I said, it crosses over that notion of where we were in week one, really, which is Harry Potter a work of science fiction, using Arthur C. Clarke's line that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from that of magic, or is it pure fantasy? And I think it's probably fair to say that Earthsea is one of those areas that does cross over the fantasy of a Tolkien, a Lewis, and so on. And Le Guin is writing this again in the 60s, where clearly the notion of the impact of the environment and the development of how we relate to the environment becomes part and parcel of people's shared consciousness, the kind of areas and the angles that they're looking to develop and so on. But I started off by actually talking about Bildungsroman, and I wanted to talk about how it was actually put together in terms of the particular tales and so on. Well, Ged the magician has got a number of names, and that other aspect, which is probably equally as important in the power as well, is kind of critical to our understanding of the text because it deals with nomenclature, the use of names, the power of names, that when you actually can name a thing in some way, shape or form, you can control the thing. The opening line from The Power is, "The shape of power is always the same. It is the shape of a tree, root to tip, central trunk branching and rebranching, spreading wider in ever thinner searching fingers. The shape of power is the outline of a living thing straining outward, sending its fine tendrils a little further and a little further yet." And I think it's a deliberate image that's placed there by Alderman, who has written Doctor Who books and, again, has proved to be quite a populist author. And hurrah, she's still alive and obviously has got a fairly long, hopefully, and a consistent writing career before her, because obviously Ursula K. Le Guin passed away a couple of years ago. But that whole sense of the image of the tree, the forked lightning, the branches, the sort of line from that perspective. Again, in terms of The Power, we see the way in which society changes, and we see the notion of which the rewriting of society, the Book of Eve. We also see something which clearly is developing the whole aspect of the mutated power of the individual. We see what happens when the males try to artificially implant their own skin. It ends in disaster. It doesn't sort of succeed in terms of how they're operating from that point of view. But digging a little bit deeper, and again considering Le Guin, look at the kind of background in terms of where the authors have come from. Le Guin very much was emerging from a world in which her parents were both very much interested in Native American history from an anthropological point of view. There was a notion of Taoism. There was a notion of that yin and yang, the masculine and the feminine, which ultimately is the synthesis of two apparent opposites, but for the benefit of all. And maybe on one level, that's actually what most ideally we're looking for in terms of equality of the genders in science fiction and so on. I mean, last week obviously we looked at Sherry S. Tepper's Grass and the strangeness of the sort of element that came within that, and the sort of aspect of that. We looked at Meshita's The Rape of Sharvi. But this is something where it's slightly more than that. It's how does society operate? We know within the world of Ged and Le Guin's work that there's a whole world that's built up in that. It's an archipelago of islands. It is, as you see there, very much looking at the whole sense of putting the map together. Now, this is the first time we use the map. There is a fairly famous philosopher, French philosopher, who also makes use of the map. And this is something we'll come on to again as we sort of become a bit more sophisticated in our appreciation of science fiction, and we look at it from The Matrix, and we look at the way in which it is a representation of reality. You know, the islands that you see up there, the islands of Earthsea and so on, they are fictional, and yet, as I say, they clearly have some kind of connotation and livelihood. Just as Middle-earth is fictional, just as Narnia is fictional. But still that notion of the map is put forward. And I'm sure some of you would already sort of acknowledge the fact that the person I'm referring to in terms of the map, in which shards of our own experience are kind of hanging from that map in a wonderful, bizarre way, is Baudrillard. Louis Baudrillard, B-A-U-D-R-I-L-L-A-R-D. Baudrillard, the French philosopher, again passed away a few years ago, but who very famously developed this whole argument of postmodernism, how postmodernism is actually seen. His concept that in essence we were the simulacrum. There was the whole notion of how within a postmodern world we simply experience our own lives through virtual symbols and a sea of virtual reality. And that again is very much played around with, because ultimately both the power and Earthsea are works of pure fiction. However, the power is set in a world which we can kind of recognise as our own. Earthsea is more in terms of the traditional notion of wizards and fables and lines that sort of connect with respect to how it operates, how it functions, how we're introduced to the characters from that. But you're still also dealing with other categorizations. You're dealing with the perception of self, the way in which we view ourselves, as opposed to not ourselves. We're seeing the whole aspect of how we see those who have the power versus those who don't have the power, and how that's generated, how it's developed. As I say, the character of Roxy goes from being very much the victim to almost the perpetrator in many ways, and then sort of develops a whole range of aspects within her particular journey and line as far as the work is actually concerned. So in terms of other sort of aspects of Bildung's Roman, how else does it connect? I mean, I mentioned it also ties in with George Lucas. Well, Lucas also uses the work of Joseph Campbell in Hero of a Thousand Faces. And if you haven't ever seen or read Joseph Campbell's Hero of a Thousand Faces, it's worth a look. It's a small but very dense book available on Amazon. I haven't actually put it in terms of the recommended reading here, but it does tie into that whole notion that, again, we'll be relating to when we start talking about the graphic narrative, graphic novel, and the work of Watchmen. So what we have here is science fiction which is expanding, it's developing. It's gone more than just the robots of RUR, the time travel of the time machine, the artificial intelligence, and the hard science of 2001 A Space Odyssey, or indeed the post-colonial fiction of what we're looking at in terms of the Apple and in terms of Rape of Shavi and so on. This is very much the whole notion of it's asking more philosophical questions. It's sci-fi with a PHI as opposed to sci-fi with science fiction. In the case of Le Guin, it's also targeted at a young adult audience. And for a long time, young adult was quite a pejorative term. I suppose probably the huge financial success of J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter tended to turn it on its head, and now you're getting a whole range of interesting writing being developed within young adult work. Although, it's fair to say, I think probably Le Guin, when she was asked originally to develop a young adult form, after initial reluctance, she took it on board, an interview that we'll show you in a few moments. Does it actually change our attitudes, though? Because that could be another line of things. We talked about science fiction as a metaphor, science fiction as an allegory. Does what we actually read about in terms of the power after the time goes by and it heads off into all sorts of other areas, etc., and we get the United States, the work of Trund, I mean, I'll sort of just work through this whole sort of system. She turns away, walks a few paces to the right, waits until she hears the snap of his camera turning off. "Don't start coming after me, son," she says out of the corner of her mouth. "I'm your friend here." Tunde notices the word "son," says nothing, holds it close to his chest. He's glad he left the audio recording running, even though the video is off. "I could have pushed you twice as hard," he says. "Mom." Margot squints at him. "I like you, Tunde," she says. "You did good work on that interview with Urban Docs. Those nuke threats really got Congress to sit up and take notice. Voted us the money we need to defend the country." You still in touch with his people? Sometimes. You hear they've got anything big coming down the pipe? You come and tell me, all right? I'll make it worth your while. There's money in it now, a lot of money. You might make a great press consultant with our training camp, with our training camps. Aha, said Tunde. I'll let you know. Clearly, one of the sort of aspects that we got as we talk in a world in which Alderman's writing from, where actually feminism and the woke movement and a whole range of other attitudes, which obviously led to changes and shifts in terms of the direction of a number of sort of classic science fiction tropes, has developed. And I think she's echoing that, and she's working through that process. But does it work as a critique in itself? And again, if I go back to what Le Guin was saying, she was very much looking at the whole notion of the huge sense of cosmology, the oneness. Does Alderman effectively separate the oneness by actually showing what it is like to be female, by showing it's what it is like to be male, and vice versa? Does it kind of clearly exaggerate the differences between the genders in a way which effectively draws our attention to the notion of inequality and the fact that in many countries and many areas of the world, even in this second decade, approaching the third decade of the 21st century, we still actually have unfair treatment, discrimination, issues that effectively should possibly have been long put to bed and so on. You know, again, the whole notion of a feminist movement which has been international, consciously revolutionary, and permeated a whole range of things. The first World Women's Day, of course, 1971. You know, here we are 50 years later. Has there been progression made in terms of equality? Or are we looking at equality, or do we want to actually invert the genders? Are those the sort of messages that are coming through within that? If we're looking at the way in which people are perceived and the way in which we see characters being perceived, then we can get into a scenario where we identify with both the leads. We share that journey, that Bildungsroman. No matter what age or gender we actually are, we can identify with the whole categories of where things are going, whether that's Huckleberry Finn, whether that happens to be Luke Skywalker, whether it happens to be Roxy, whether it happens actually arguably to a certain extent be Alice in Wonderland, or perhaps that's a different issue for another time in terms of fantasies and so on. But if we actually consider this whole notion of how the greyness between fantasy and fiction is being portrayed, then you've got two texts here that equally raise issues and hopefully provide a pleasure for the audience in terms of how we're viewing those histories as well. Let's have a listen briefly to Le Guin herself when she's talking about how she was thinking about what she'd been asked originally to come up with the whole concept of Earthsea and what the impression was with respect to her thoughts and views.
In 1968, when the publisher of Parnassus Books came to me and said, would you write a young adult novel? Because I want to start a line of young adult books. And I said, no. I've never written for children. I've never written for an audience. Specifically, you know, I couldn't do that. I sort of ran away. I was terrified. Mm-hmm. But then I thought about it. And I thought, well, you know, adolescents are people. They're very good readers. Sometimes they're the best readers of all. And so what? Okay, what makes a young adult book? Having a young adult central character. Well, I can do that. I had written a couple of short stories, very light short stories, that took place on these islands where there were wizards and dragons. And when I sort of began thinking about a book, these islands grew and just boom, it sort of, this is a whole archipelago of islands, and now I draw the map. And so the first thing I did for the book was the map. And I have always used that map, all six books. What my readers tell me about the Earthsea books, all of them, all six of them, particularly what young people tell me, or people who were young when they first read A Wizard of Earthsea, or the first trilogy, they tell me it helped them figure out their own way through life. That it was somehow useful to them, and that they could identify with Geb or with Tenar with the problems that they faced, and sort of that helped them with their own problems. And this is something that it did not occur to me. I didn't know I was being helpful to anybody. I was just telling a story I wanted to tell, which obviously had very deep sources in my own life. And so it is wonderful to be told by your readers that they love your book because when they read it, they needed it, and it kind of came to them like a friend. And that is a lovely thing to be told as a writer.
When they needed the book, it arrived and it came to them. It's a very metaphysical approach to how we actually approach literature, how literature, and in particular the genre of science fiction, kind of really connects at a time when perhaps we can identify our experiences in the literature with the characters. It's one of the reasons why, again, jumping ahead a little, when we start considering the notion of the graphic narrative and the characters of the X-Men in terms of the mutants, they've been used variously from Marvel universe as either synonymous for disaffected youth, for the gay movement, for the Jewish population, for a whole variety of sort of aspects in terms of how the characters are being portrayed as outsiders and so on, and that sort of aspect which Stan Lee was certainly looking for to provide superheroes who actually had problems and challenges within that. But in this particular instance, obviously the Gwyn's talking primarily about her characters in Earthsea and the way she's actually developed that and how she felt it was important to almost have, as I say, a teaching method behind it, sort of a line which had its roots very much in, as we mentioned, Native American concepts of dream time, Native American concepts of the cosmos and the sort of the oneness that's actually there. Does Altman do the same thing? Well, I would argue that there are connections between that in terms of the Book of Eve, the way in which he sort of rewrites the thing. And the whole text, ironically, is developed and framed as a historical aspect. It's, I mean, that framing which she provides is a really interesting technique that's actually used because it puts the author, the reader, already in the prospect or in the sort of position of almost being omniscient. We, gender non-specific, can actually read through the experiences of the character as and the characters, you know, Tunde and Roxy and so on, as they develop, as they evolve from this phenomenon which suddenly manifests itself and then effectively the sort of the relations and how society changes as a result. So it's dealing again with that whole notion of change, and maybe that's another aspect to bear in mind for science fiction. Science fiction can, another fun definition coming up, be defined as the literature of change. The literature of change. It's the way in which, as Brian Aldiss said, it acts as a prophylactic against future shock. It's a way in which we can use techniques, going back to that line about the book arrives when we're ready for it. The text comes when we can appreciate it, when we can identify with it, in whichever form it actually is. Let's say the tropes that you see in Earthsea aren't hugely innovative. You know, the notion of a young magician, I mean, it goes back to Sorcerer's Apprentice and all sorts of other areas, and the way in which Ged goes through his own particular tales and realises that sometimes, you know, he makes mistakes, he makes errors and so on. But at the same time, the change in the naming, Sparrowhawk, the character, you know, as he becomes Jed, Sparrowhawk, etc., how the names of his particular personas impact on himself. And again, that ties in with the Native American notion of a spirit guide.
the fact that, and this is, again, nothing new, fans of Emperor's Dark Materials, episode 2 last night, anybody see it?
Yeah.
Yeah, good, excellent. You know, the whole sort of aspects, are you getting that with respect to demons and spirit soul guides who kind of wander along with you? That's the same sort of thing that if you are going on a dream quest within the Native American culture, you would effectively sort of seek out a particular animal, a particular spirit guide to actually guide you through the system. It's very much a holistic approach to how we view our existence and how we make sense of this thing called life. From the perspective of both an anthropological perspective. You know, where is the science here, you might well say? Well, it's the science of anthropology. It's the science of how things are seen from that. It's the science of how, arguably, sociology as well. And again, not a huge surprise, because Le Guin's parents were sociologists. You know, they're working through that process. The new sciences are coming through. Here we have, in the 60s, the first of that new branch, which we looked at, obviously with J.G., with Ballard's work on the drowned world, etc., where it's not the hard science, it's not the science of chemistry and physics and mathematics and cosmology. This is, some might say, the even harder science of human beings. Because we can predict, through Newtonian physics, what's going to happen if you drop something, or you're working on a planet with gravity, it'll fall down, fall towards that. We know what Newton's laws of motion are, etc. We know about the law of momentum. We know about the mathematics that can explain that. But in terms of human beings, you're always going to get the unexpected. That's probably the only one guarantee that you can actually have. You know, again, in approximately 52 minutes from now, we have a 2-minute silence. 100 ready second silence, in which we remember the dead of 2 world wars and many, many more world wars since. People still dying. Syria, the Syrian conflict, has now been going on for longer than the Second World War. And yet here we are, you know, still muddling through, still going through that sort of process. Does that actually say anything about ourselves as human beings? Does it say anything about the power systems that actually get there? Or is it simply a case of, well, it'd be a lot better if women had the power to actually just electrically shock people as and when they work through that? I mean, it would have sorted out Harvey Weinstein to start off with, wouldn't it, really? But in terms of those sort of issues that work through that, both Alderman, and Alderman again is writing very much from a contemporary viewpoint, because again, she's probably the first writer that we consider has been very much of a contemporary nature. The second next one we go on to will probably be William Gibson to a certain extent with cyberpunk, and then of course the whole notion of the weird fiction of China Miéville. But in terms of those particular sort of foci, the way in which they're presented to us and put out from the point of view of the narrative, etc., they're inviting the reader to make those kind of comparisons, connotations, and so on and so forth. I put another sort of one of the sort of links here, which again you can listen to the whole thing on where we actually do consider the Alderman as part of the Alderman power novel as a sort of book of the month from that point of view. But the exciting thing now is that I do have a strange form of register. It's a sheet of paper. The reason you might say, why is he handing out a sheet of paper? It's because the computer has let us down. And this week, I'm going to have to ask you for once to actually just put your name in block capitals and then sign beside it, just to prove you're actually here. And then somebody will have the joy of putting that back into into the computer. So it was a problem that occurred on Friday. And today I turned up and no. And they said they'll drop it off if it was. And they're not going to. So there we are. The other thing I'd like to do, though, is to move on to another sort of little group exercise. And again, from the sort of handout that I'm going to give you, I'd just like you to effectively either apply the questions to whichever one most people in your group have actually studied. So although it's kind of relating primarily to Wilson, look at the first 4 sort of questions. And just look at a couple of key things there. And then we'll talk about how those things can be developed. Well, I think you work in groups of maybe 3 or 4, if that's okay. Thank you.
I have written it himself.